Let me tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Perini received his PhD in political science from Yale University in 1962. He has taught at a number of colleges and universities, including State University of New York, at Stony Brook and at Albany, the University of Vermont, at Sarah Lawrence College. He was a guest professor of political science at Howard University for 1987-88, a guest professor at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, since 1989, and a distinguished resident professor at California State University, Northridge, spring 1990. His articles have appeared in The Nation, The Progressive, Political Affairs, American Political Science Review, Journal of Politics, Politics and Society, Witness, National Catholic Reporter, Harvard International Review. There's much more here. It goes on and on. He has received research grants from the Social Science Research Council and the Ford Foundation, the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, and various universities. The one thing that I noticed is that Dr. Perini is a great historian, and he quoted another great historian. It was Charles Beard who said, "Whoever leaves economic pressures out of history or out of the discussion of public questions is in mortal peril of substituting mythology for reality and confusing issues instead of clarifying them." Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored this evening to present a truly clarifying voice who courageously talks to those who would invent our reality, Dr. Michael Perini.
Well, I was reading that, hearing that resume, Ford Foundation, Social Science Research Council. I won those awards about 25 years ago before I ever started speaking out in the manner of speaking now. And I couldn't get within 2 miles of the Ford Foundation now. And it's part of the price one pays for speaking the truth. I remember in 1969, I was really called a promising young political scientist, and I was getting all sorts of rather fat offers for senior positions already, associate professors and all this stuff. And then a funny thing happened to me on the way to success. I discovered the truth, and I began saying, wait a minute, this Vietnam War isn't very nice. And I began speaking out on it, and not only speaking out, but acting on it, and getting arrested, and getting beaten up by the police, and thrown in jail, and sentenced to 2 years probation, all these things. And all those offers suddenly disappeared. Here I had published in all the leading journals, and I was still a promising young political scientist, but I had committed that sin, and that sin was thou shalt not commit a truth. And when you start doing that, when you start saying, I started saying worse things. It wasn't only opposing the war and bemoaning the symptoms of an unjust society, but I began to then doing a very dangerous thing, which was analyze those things as to whose interests were involved. And what's going on? The thing you can never get when you watch those Sunday TV news talk shows or evening news or any other news, you can never get them to get into that. And so that's what I sort of wanted to do here today. I wanted to give you a very analytical talk. This looks like a real up crowd and you're in for a rouser, but I got a more analytic talk tonight, if that's okay. I know you, rascal. I want to begin by saying that our political system might be thought of as a dual system. Now, we have two political systems involved. The first one is composed of the relatively visible system of elections, political personalities, public pronouncements, image engineering, and that handful of issues that bestir the government and actually catch the myopic vision of the news media from time to time. This system is taught in the schools, it's dissected by academics, and it's gossiped about by news pundits, and we sort of know it. It's what we call politics, government. Then there's also a system of state. That's a system that involves the financial structure of the political economy, the basic interests of finance capital, both domestic and international, and the linkage of state power to securing those basic interests. the needs of organized centers of wealth and economic power, as typified by the modern giant multinational corporation. This system is not taught in the schools. How many of you learned about that in Civics 101 or American Gov 101? It's not discussed in any critical detail in the media. Cokie Roberts and Daniel Shore seem never to have heard of it. William Buckley has heard of it, and in fact he's part of it, but he never mentions it because he's too preoccupied with the excessive power wielded by welfare mothers and the unemployed and the advocates of affirmative action. So he doesn't bother us with that. This dual system, I'm making here a conceptual distinction about what are really empirically overlapping phenomena. Obviously, in many cases, these things occupy the same place and the same dynamic, or parts of the same dynamic. This brings us to the distinction of what some Marxists have called the distinction between the government and the state. Marxists. This guy is mentioning Marxists. I'm not only mentioning Marxists, I am a Marxist. Woo! How could you be a Marxist? Now, if this was a Soviet audience, you'd go, how could you be a Marxist, my Soviet intellectual friends? Marx, how could you quote Marx? I said, because unlike you, I lived in capitalism and I know what Marx was talking about. And you are going to get your turn and you're going to learn what Marx was talking about. Because Marx was talking about capital. His great book was not called Communism or Socialism. Marx was a social pathologist. He looked at the illness, the dynamic, the laws of political motion and development, and his great book was called Das Kapital. It was about capitalism and imperialism. Those are the subjects that he knew about. Those are the phenomena that we have been fighting for years. And the Soviets, never having been exposed to the dynamics of that, learned their Marxism like an empty catechism, and it seems not relevant to them. But Marx is very relevant. And one of the relevant conceptual distinctions made is that between the government and the state. The government deals with interest group conflicts and popular demands. It provides the cloak and some of the substance of democratic rule. I don't want to say there's no democracy. Some of the substance, there is some democracy in this society. But whatever little democracy we have is something that we fought for and we got by our organized actions, by generations of struggles. We had to extract that from the people who had power and property. And there's always that antagonism. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to defend themselves from the powers of wealth and property. That's what democracy is. And the state has some of the substance of democratic rule. The government. The state is something else. The state is the mechanism of final control, of class control. Engels makes the point that the first armed bands of men, retainers to the first big property owners back in the late horticultural society, when men had all this property and they decided they needed someone to protect the property, and they began to hire people, put them on retainer and give them guns to protect that property. That was the beginning of the state. That was the first embryonic state. Max Weber, the great German sociologist, who is not a Marxist, anti-Marxist, in fact, he says the state's essential trait, its irreducible feature, is that it has a monopoly over the uses of legitimate force and violence. Over the legitimate uses. Legitimate force meaning legally sanctioned, authorized by the legally constituted authorities. That's what the state is about. Now, what is the significance of making this conceptual distinction? In good social science, you should never introduce distinctions unless they lead to empirical feedbacks. Much of social science doesn't do that. It does toxicology. It says, let's call this, to this, to this, to this, to this, to that, and you memorize those 11 things and you get them on the exam at the end of the term. But what is the reason for that distinction? The reason is because it allows us to understand something, that the taking office in government may not always guarantee full access to state power. Allende in Chile, in 1971-73, was able to win election as president of Chile. He took over the government. He could begin to formulate certain policies, but he never could get his hands on the state apparatus. The military, the police, the security forces, the intelligence services, the courts, the structured, fundamental, organic laws that rigged the whole system for the property class. He couldn't get to that. And in fact, when he began to make inroads, and when democracy began to work and move against the powers of property and privilege, that's when the state came down on the democratically elected government. And Allende was murdered. He was murdered. The democratic government of Chile was murdered, both figuratively and literally, by the autocratic, anti-capitalist, U.S.-supported state. When the state destroyed his government, it destroyed the democracy that had produced his government. The new Chilean constitution, by the way, explicitly keeps the state separate from government and says the military shall have its own budget. That budget is not answerable to the Congress, the Chilean Congress, and the military has veto power over certain essential areas. So you have a state elevated, you see, to explicit constitutional position. It's interesting, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, you see something of the same, where Mrs. Chamorro is in power and has governance, but elements of the state are still in the hands of the Sandinistas. However, they're nowhere as powerful as the military in Chile was, because that particular state was operating in a larger context of power that came from the United States, which gave them funds and monies and support. And whatever else, and continually encircled and threatened and undermined the Allende government. The Sandinistas don't have that power, but they still have, what they still have is some, that's why you don't see any death squads going on in Nicaragua right now. That's the only reason, is because the Sandinistas still have some control over the military and the police. But they have very little control over really the long-range conditions of policy. And in that case, it's a very weakened condition of state, because you have this larger state again moving in, but this time on the side of government. And the reason Bush hasn't given aid, hasn't done the things and all the good things he would have done for Pinochet, and he did do it when he was in the CIA, is because is for that very reason. The Sandinista, elements of the Sandinista state have not yet been totally eradicated and destroyed, which is what the State Department is operating looking for. The inherent function of the capitalist state is to defend the capitalist order. That's what the founding fathers made very clear. They didn't use the word capitalist. They didn't even think of themselves as capitalist. The term hadn't quite yet been invented. But they said the purpose of government is to secure the interests of people of property against those who have not property. That is the ultimate and the final irreducible thing it must do. Now, capitalist mythology argues the opposite. It says that government is part of the problem. The less government, the better. That right-wing ideology is rather ironic, because the private capitalist system is publicly grounded in state power. Every corporation in America is publicly chartered. That is, it's made a legal entity by the state. And with that public charter from the state, it has police protections. It can protect its property. It can call the police in. It could do all sorts of things. Its privileges are guaranteed by the state. Indeed, in the economy, there's no such thing as a legal entity without the state. No such thing as private economic holdings. I mean, you know, your shoes and your jacket, but I'm talking about actual property, homes, whatever else. There's no such thing as private property without public authority. It's ironic that those who are overweened on state power keep talking about the intrusion of government in. It's really not ironic, however. Right-wingers say government cannot solve problems, government is the problem, they want less government. Where do they want less government? In human services? environmental defenses, in consumer safety protection, in health care, education, support for the needy, in housing. They want privatization of public sector functions. So they're all against government. But they support more government intrusion into our lives. You look at other areas, and they want more government. They want repressive police measures. They want electronic surveillance. They want restrictions on free speech and information access. They want government censorship of films and even art exhibits and photo exhibits, if we listen to that little fascist Jesse Helms. They want restrictions on access to media. They want to abolish the fairness doctrine, and in fact have abolished the fairness doctrine regarding the media. They want expansion of the powers and prerogatives of the FBI and other security agencies. They want large military establishment. They want militarism. Considerations of national security have primacy over individual rights to travel. Limitations on individual rights to travel because of national security. Someone said, Cuba is a country that should allow its people to leave if they want to leave. Well, Castro is allowing them. He's offered to send as many as would like to go to the U.S., and the U.S. has refused. Only if you get in a boat and you swim out there in a desperate act of escape, then they take you. If you go sneakily out of Cuba, then you'll be treated as a hero, someone who escaped from tyranny. But if you came on a passenger boat, you're rejected and turned back. And the restriction to travel is not on the Cuban side, it's on this side. We can't go to Cuba. They've restricted our right to go to Cuba in terms of the right to use currency and pay and all that sort of thing. Access to information and all that sort of thing. Well, isn't there an inconsistency here among the George Bush people? They, on one hand, on some issues, the conservatives want less government. On other issues, they want more government. No, there's nothing inconsistent about it. The one thing George Bush isn't is inconsistent. He is always consistent. He is always consistently doing that one thing. Never inconsistent. When he gets up and he looks at communist China, and there's repression, Tiananmen Square and all that, and he turns to people and he says, let's be patient with them, let's not impose a litmus test, let's cultivate friendly relations with China, let's not go and punish them because of what's happened, let's not interfere in their internal affairs. That's not inconsistent with what he said about the Soviet Union just last year. We need more reforms, we want to see more democracy, or Cuba. Unless until you do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, we are not going to deal with you. We do have a litmus test. We will impose our own preferences on you. We do have a timetable for you. We do interfere with your internal affairs. But there's nothing inconsistent about that, because China is doing what he wants. And Cuba hasn't been doing what he wants. China is giving him capitalism. It's opened up his country. The enormous cheap labor markets has allowed private corporations to come in, almost write their own terms in some areas, although the Chinese now are catching wise and trying to put some restrictions and saying a certain percentage has to be reinvested here and all that sort of thing. They're beginning to understand that capitalists don't invest in your country to help you, but to help themselves. But still, if it's a question of choosing between Soviet Union of last year, which had democracy without the capitalism, and it had democracy, was allowing free elections, open critical media, all sorts of incredible widespread ideological spread that was far wider than what you get in the mainstream media in this country. If it's a question of choosing democracy without the capitalism, or as in China, capitalism without democracy, then you choose the capitalism without democracy. Or the same in Chile. If it was a question of choosing the democracy of Allende, but one that was beginning to infringe upon the prerogatives of profit and property, or democracy that was threatening capitalism, or capitalism that had crushed democracy, you pick the latter. It was Henry Kissinger who said about Chile, if we have to choose between the economy and democracy, we must pick the economy. That's the most essential thing. That's the closest Henry Kissinger has ever come to uttering the truth. It was a half-truth. The truth should have been, if we have to choose between a saving a capitalist democracy and the economy. There's nothing wrong with that economy under Allende from an ordinary economic point of view, how people were developing. In fact, there was a shift of the gross national income. A portion, a good percentage, was shifting from that portion of the population that lived off interest and dividends and went to that portion of the population that lived off wages and salaries. And that's what was wrong. So there's nothing inconsistent in his position, Bush's position, vis-a-vis China and vis-a-vis Cuba. Underneath is the same consistent dedication to the forces of capital accumulation, to the powers and prerogatives of U.S. multinational corporations. That is the irreducible component and the irreducible consistency. The same class interests, that want less human services, less distributive egalitarian public sector policies, and more restrictions on democratic forces that seek to contain class power and expand egalitarian policies. So it's perfectly consistent even here at home. They want less government but more state power, because less government and more state power support the same conservative class interests. It's perfectly consistent. George Bush is always consistent. I didn't mean to say that he's always truthful. He's never truthful, but he's always consistent. If you understand what he's really doing, George Bush is never true. The old joke about Reagan is true about Bush too. How do you know when he's telling the truth? When his lips stop moving. Even a conservative policy like the newly found advocacy for compulsory pregnancy that conservatives have developed in the last 12 years. Now, one of the most liberal pro-choice laws ever passed was in the state of California under Ronald Reagan, who some of your neighbors voted for. And in fact, there were a few, if they became honest before they read the right books, also voted for him. I'm not even going to mention names. Okay. George Bush used to say that he was for legal abortion. Most conservatives in the early Warren Court were for legal abortion. I remember that. It was the Warren Court. It was the Berger Court, I'm sorry. The Berger, Nixon-appointed Berger Court that passed Roe versus Wade. It was a conservative court. And in those days, the position was very simple. That the reason the poor are poor is they have too many babies. You know, the poor suffer from a certain kind of incontinence all the time, and they don't have the virtues that we have. And so let them have legal abortions, there'll be less of them on welfare. Now, there's an obvious class interest that's involved here. I don't mean the obvious class bias. When you have compulsory pregnancy, and when abortion is outlawed, of course, then women with money can fly to Mexico or Denmark, and women without money must face compulsory pregnancy, unwanted pregnancy. That's the class bias that is one of the effects of the policy. I'm talking about the class interest behind that policy, where suddenly, in the late 70s, conservatives discovered that here was an issue that they could cut into class issues. I mean, they're always looking for non-economic issues to cut in against the populist bread-and-butter issues of the many versus the few. And here was an issue that could cut the Catholic Democratic vote, the Protestant fundamentalist vote, the Jewish conservative orthodoxy vote, and they could cut in with this issue, and they all suddenly became advocates of compulsory pregnancy. They laughingly call it pro-life. I don't see what's pro-life about a woman dying on a kitchen table with a clothes hanger. But they became advocates of compulsory pregnancy because here was an issue, like a number of other cultural issues, morality issues, gay bashing, school prayers, busing, flag waving, affirmative action, so forth, that can split the public against each other. The abolition of legal abortion, by the way, will be, as you know, a very big defeat for democracy and for women's basic rights and for women's survival. It is seriously threatened. It would be nice if many of the pro-choice spokespeople would stop saying that this will take us back to the days of before Roe versus Wade. It will not. The decision that's waiting around the corner, maybe not the first, maybe not the second, but eventually it could have been two decisions back if Scalia had had his way and could have convinced Sandra Day O'Connor. He said, look, we've got the votes, let's do it. The decision is not going to take you back to before Roe versus Wade, because before Roe versus Wade, the decision on abortion was left to the states under the residual clause in the Constitution, the residual rights of the states, which said that the state has the rights and powers to regulate the health and morals of the people. So if you think a bad decision comes in, but little old California, liberal California is going to take care of it, we won't bother, that isn't what's going to happen. The new decision will be to give the fetus person status, that the fetus will be declared a person, and under the 14th Amendment, an abortion, therefore, will be the denial of equal protection under the laws or due process of the law, and it will be illegal all over the country. And under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, that will be the federal law, and no state can then pass a law that is in violation of the federal law. When they get finished with with Roe versus Wade, there are going to be no legal abortions anywhere in this country ever again. And the only thing then that could stop that oligarchic power of the Supreme Court would be a constitutional amendment, which would take maybe 10 years to do. But it might also unleash a tremendous political force in the states, which might redound deleteriously on conservative interests. The last page of that hasn't been written yet. Generally speaking, getting back to this question of state and government, the Parliament or the Congress represents the government and the issues of governance. The executive, the monarch, the president, usually represents the state or are closest to the state functions. Even in England, the Prime Minister represents the state, but even the Queen of England, we always hear the Queen is just a powerless monarch. She's not so powerless. The Queen of England is the richest woman in the world, the richest family in the world, and besides that, she has powers under the Commonwealth law to perpetrate little coups, right? The parliamentary, wasn't it in the province in Canada, where the Crown interceded and got rid of a Labour government, and got rid of the Labour government in Australia on certain technicalities. There are European states that have both a Prime Minister and a President, or Prime Minister and a monarch, as I just said. Usually the executive of the government is also the executive of the state, generally. Now Marx is often misquoted on this. It's often said that Marx said that the state is the executive committee of the bourgeoisie. Marx never said that. In the Communist Manifesto, he and Engels said, the executive of the state is a committee of the whole for the bourgeoisie. The executive, he focused specifically on the executive, and that recognizes two things. One, that there can be other components of government that can be arenas of struggle. That government itself can be an arena of struggle. In fact, even within our executive, you can see different tendencies. The executive, as represented by Housing and Human Services, or Health and Human Services, the Department of Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, is sort of has one configuration, social formation and interest, as opposed to the executive as represented by the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, or the Department of Commerce. And Marx here was recognizing the particularly crucial role in government that's played by the executive in state power and class supremacy. Now that line between state and government is not a perfectly clear, impermeable one. As I said, it's empirically overlapping. In our system and in some others, the president, the highest office of government, is also the executor of state power. I'm repeating myself, I know. Unless he's a liberal or progressive, who attempts to run in and democratize the class functions of the state. Think of it this way. If a Jesse Jackson were elected president or someone of that politics, he would have a hard time getting control of the state. Carter, when President Carter was in, and Carter was hardly a liberal. We haven't had a liberal since John Kennedy, and you know what happened to John Kennedy. Carter tried to appoint Theodore Sorensen as head of the CIA. It was it was made known to him very quickly from the CIA and from the key people in the Senate Intelligence Committee that Sorensen would never have a chance of confirmation. The Senate was able to react and act very quickly to a president. That particular component of the Senate, which represents an extension of state power, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and said, we will never pass on this guy and let him be confirmed. And Carter, who was hardly a Jesse Jackson or a crusader, pulled Sorensen back. Sometimes democratic pressures do allow the government to rein the state in a bit, as when the Church Committee exposed the CIA. With enough agitation, with enough struggle, these issues got publicized. They broke in to the media, and eventually something had to be done. When guidelines and restrictions were put on the FBI, Iran-Contra, and the various other investigations we will see. Generally, however, the component of government that acts in investigating this is often complicit with the state. It's always that same committee that's got, I can't even remember their names now, Simpson and the jokers who were talking to Hatch, yeah, he's the one I blocked. The Iran-Contra hearings shows you that kind of ambivalent complicit function. The joint congressional committee that was formed really had a dual function. It had a function of government and a function of state. The function of government was to reassure the public that these unlawful, illegal, unconstitutional doings would be exposed, that there was a cleansing process here, that we would look into and investigate and punish the culprits. The function of state is not to destabilize the state too much. The same people who supposedly were saying, we must get to the bottom of this, would then say, we'll never get to the bottom of this. It is of such magnitude. The same people were saying, we cannot afford, what this country needs, a successful presidency. You know, we had Watergate, and we've had Nixon taken out and all that, and so we cannot destabilize it too much. So those same members of Congress who supposedly are to investigate it and let the cards fall where they may were constantly making statements about how concerned about where the cards might actually fall. So more often it is the state that penetrates government. Congressional intelligence committees are usually filled by conservative Republicans and conservative or moderate Democrats, the Les Aspin, Sam Nunn type of Democrats, who identify completely with the needs of the national security state and who would not confirm a Theodore Sorensen. It's interesting, the Bush administration was stunned at the appointment of 5 liberals to the House Intelligence Committee. Of the 20 or so members, 5 were liberals, known to be liberals, and the Bush administration let it be known that this was outrageous. They were saying that this intelligence committee has a very special relationship to the state, to class power, and we don't even want liberals there. Democratic controversy and exposure might result. So there's an ideological test. When Texas Democrat Jim Wright became Speaker of the House, leader of the opposition party, the most important spokesperson of the opposition, and in fact, the second most influential person in government, it is said, I don't think so, but Speaker of the House, he also began to raise questions that got media coverage, that's what a speaker can do, regarding the doings of state, and Wright questioned state policy in Nicaragua. And I said, this is amazing. The Speaker of the House is actually questioning the policies of imperialism, of U.S. imperialism. Now, that's something you really can't do. You can't do that in the media. You can't really do that in government that often. You can get a story in the media about toxic waste dumps. You can get a story about a business corporation that's ripping off or polluting. You can get a story about waste in the Pentagon's procurement, weapons procurement system. You can get a story about this, you can get a story about that. You can attack these various things, and that's when conservatives complain that they see a liberal conspiracy in the media. The thing you can't do in the media, in an editorial, a column, or a letter to the editor even, let me tell you, I published I've published about 7 or 8 things in the New York Times, including 2 op-ed columns. I've published about the same number in the Washington Post. I published 1 op-ed in the L.A. Times. But one thing you can't talk about is the essence of that capitalist interest and the goal of U.S. policy and the function of U.S. policy and the interests involved in imperialism and intervention. And Wright would get up, and he was hardly someone who made a critique of imperialism, but he was saying things like, what is all this about? We're not helping the poor people. We seem to be helping the rich people in Central America. And I said, I don't think Jim Wright is going to be around very long. But I forgot. I thought he was going to get blown away, but he wasn't. He just, they have an easier way to get rid of Congress people. The Justice Department just went through his background with a fine-tooth comb and found questionable financial dealings. But that led to a problem. The next person in line was the House Majority Leader, Tony Coelho. And he, too, was a liberal. So they also put him under investigation, and they found some questionable financial dealings, which you can find with just about most of these people in Congress, because it's very, very seldom are they able to pay their election costs without cutting deals and cutting corners in one way or another. And then so they went and dug a little further. The next guy in line was I forget his name now. It was an African-American leader, Bill Gray, thank you very much. And what happened with him? He wasn't knocked out, was he? But he was just eased aside. I think it was, he let it be known. And they got Tom Foley, a flaccid, puffy, Tip O'Neill update. Totally collaborationist with the Bush administration. Gets up and keeps telling us what a great leader George Bush has been. One of the people who was proud to vote for the resolution and the Gulf massacre. Talking about George Bush's unerring leadership. That's the kind of opposition that they can live with. One that would never raise a question about what the state has been doing. Well, the U.S. capitalist state, and George Bush just said this yesterday, I heard him on CNN, he said, the United States is a world leader, and people know that we are providing leadership for the entire world. How about leadership for East Harlem or New Jersey, Jersey City housing problems, or Chesapeake Bay, cleaning that up? George Bush has got his eye on the big apple. What does it mean to be world leader? It means having the primary role maintaining the global system of capital investment and capital accumulation, making the world safe for the multinationals, making the world safe for the largest, most powerful, and richest group of capitalists in the world. And that's not the Japanese, it's not the Germans, it's the Americans. The biggest corporations in the world, if you look at the world corporations, the top 10 in the world, of those, about 7 are still American. And most of the big banks are still American dominated. It's but making the world safe for the American capitalists and also for the Japanese, German, British, and Swedish capitalists and all the other capitalists. The primary role, French, British, Israeli, those others, they play subsidiary roles in certain parts of the world. They play sub-imperialist, neo-colonial roles. How do you make the world safe and profitable for investment and accumulation? By preventing competing systems from emerging and making life miserable and dysfunctional for those that do. The goal is to bring them back to the client-state fold. If they are socialist countries, you spend literally 70 years. 70 years from the day that Soviet Russia came into existence, you have trade embargoes, encirclement, invasions, monetary embargoes, everything else you can think of for 70 years until you distort and weaken that revolution. If you want to see that process encapsulated in more modern terms, just look at what was done to Nicaragua in a few years. That's exactly what you do. Encircle, invade, attack, starve it out, whatever else. The goal is to bring them back to a client state fold. A client state is a state which is run by a comprador class. A comprador class is a ruling class that is in total collusion with foreign investors, that is very rich and sees it the mainstay of its power in the bayonets and guns and military assistance and economic assistance that comes from the metropolitan imperialist country. It opens up its country to those foreign investors and gets its cut for it, for its own self, its relatives and friends and brothers-in-laws and whatever else. It's a client state that it offers cheap labor, cheap natural resources, open markets, foreign investment rather than indigenous development. Competing systems mean not only socialist or communist systems, but even nationalist, populist nationalist ones. Even now, even right-wing nationalist, even conservative nationalist ones like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, you see. Libya, Indonesia under Sukarno, Egypt under Colonel Nasser. You know what Colonel Nasser did when he took over in the Colonel's Rebellion in Egypt? He threw out a comprador class. He threw out a client-state collaborationist. He threw out Fatboy King Farouk, who was called the Playboy King, who knew about as much about his country as he knew nothing about his country. I know how to finish that. I mean, when they got to King Farouk's palace, you know what they found? I was a kid. I remember I saw the newsreels. I wasn't a kid. I was in college at the time. I saw the newsreels, though. They had rooms full of girly magazines that King Farouk had. He had rooms and rooms full of girly magazines. He had a fleet of cars. He spent most of his time in Monte Carlo. You could say, what a terrible leader for Egypt. No, that's the kind of leader they wanted. It's the kind of leader that throws the country open. Take what you want, just give me my playthings, you see. And Nasser came in. And for the first time in the history of the Egyptian people, they got public education. For the first time in the history of the Egyptian people, they got free health clinics. That's what Nasser started doing. And he made claim to the Suez Canal. And he said, that canal goes through our country. We're going to start collecting the fees on it. We're going to run it. Enough of your colonialism and imperialism. And Secretary of State John Foster Dulles said that Amil Nasser, President Nasser of Egypt, was the Hitler of the Nile. You see? Sounds familiar? Hitler. Gaddafi was the Hitler of Libya. Saddam Hussein was worse than Hitler, as Georgie told us. Worse than Hitler. He was worse. We could live with Hitler. Hitler allowed investments. When Hitler came to power in Germany, he privatized the public sector and gave it back to the cartels. When Hitler came to power, he cut income taxes for the rich. He abolished inheritance taxes for the rich. He abolished labor unions. He abolished opposition political parties. He allowed, and profits went up and up for the German cartels. That's our kind of guy. He's not so bad. He was misunderstood in many ways. But this Nasser doing this kind of thing, daring to take something that is ours and giving it to the people, well, that's when we start all these stories. And Gaddafi did the same thing in Libya. And that's what Saddam Hussein did to some limited degree in Iraq. Saddam Hussein was trying to cut a better deal for oil and oil prices to use that money for the development in his own country. And it's not true that they bombed that country back to the 19th century. Because that country in the 19th century had a social structure, ecological base, and material base that was commensurate with the population needs of the 19th century. They bombed it back to something else, to some just total destruction. And it's not true that they just carpet bombed. They're absolutely right when they said our bombing was surgical. They surgically removed the life support systems of the society. They surgically removed the electrical systems so water couldn't get through, so sewerage couldn't operate properly. And that's why we're getting cholera now. And that's why we're getting 100,000 dead, and the dying hasn't stopped in Iraq. They were very, very good at what they did. And it was because this guy had the temerity to say, I want to set some of these terms myself. I want to have some say in what happens to the oil in my country so that some of this can come back for my development. Now, are you saying these capitalists are so mean and so selfish that they want to see people starve and die? No, they just want as much as they can get for themselves. They never even give it a thought. If pressed on the point, what do you think about the condition of third world people? They have a whole elaborate set of rationales given to them by my academic colleagues, which is that these third world people is just culturally deficient, are traditionally resistant to change, can't get the hang of new technologies and all that sort of thing, and that's why they're poor. They presume that poverty was an original condition. And we're actually helping them by bringing in all this investment, etc., etc. The price of that world leadership is high, not for U.S. capitalists, but for U.S. taxpayers. The mechanism of control and command employed by the state, that mechanism is known as the National Security State, formed under the National Security Act of 1947, composed of the Executive Office of the White House, the President, the National Security Council, the National Security Administration, which is a large intelligence and covert action agency as big as the CIA. We don't hear much about it. The Defense Intelligence Agency and elements of the Pentagon, the Joint Chief of Staffs, the CIA, and some components of the FBI. That's what I define as the national security state. Now, if you go back, you looked at the Constitution itself had provisions in it which revealed state functions. Not government, but state functions. There should be militias. The Constitution said there shall be state militias and an army and federal armories can be and troops can be stationed in every state. And that was used in the class wars of the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, the great mining and railroad strikes. The capitalists were very happy about that provision in the Constitution because they could call in federal troops when the state militias refused to fire on the workers, when the police refused to fight with the workers, where they could bring in the U.S. Army. And that's why you have armories in different states and different places in the different cities throughout the country. Those armories were built to provide a depot, a mustering point for U.S. troops when they're brought in to suppress workers and strikers. The Constitution, they were used to put down these disturbances and insurrections. There has to be a national army and a navy. The right of habeas corpus, and therefore the freedom of the individual, can be suspended during national emergencies and insurrections. There are no procedural safeguards provided as to how that might come about. A presidential edict can do it. The Constitution has provisions for its own suspension, for the suspension of government and the direct rule by presidential edict. Why? Because again, the primary function is not to guarantee your rights. The primary function is to guarantee the stability of those who have the wealth and the property, even if that means a suspension of your rights. The national security state seeks to remove itself from democratic governance. Look at, for instance, the CIA's secret budget. The CIA is on a totally secret budget. That secret budget is explicitly in violation of the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 9, Paragraph 7 reads, "No money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time." Well, there are no receipts and statements and expenditures of the public monies that have been spent on the CIA. Billions. It's estimated, the guesstimate is, and members of the intelligence committees have thrown some figures around, $34-45 billion a year spent on the intelligence communities. That's the CIA, the DIA, the NSA, and the others. The function the goal is to make the state as self-operating as possible without the interferences of democratic governance. CIA involvement in the drug trade was partly that. It makes drugs, first of all, highly available for troublesome elements of the population, depoliticizing them. You don't see what you see in the 60s in the ghettos or the barrios. You don't see the Young Lords or the Black Panthers anymore. You don't see revolutionary movements. What you see, why not? Because they're too busy shooting themselves up with needles in each other with guns. And that stuff has been pouring in. And believe me, supply helps to create demand. Those people didn't demand drugs. They weren't out there saying, give us some, give us some. But when it's on every street corner and people are and kids are invited to try it, it certainly increases consumption. That's true of any commodity in society. Supply, the accessibility, availability of the supply is a major factor in determining demand. The CIA involvement in the drug trade makes money for CIA operatives who dip into it. They go into business for themselves, corruption. Richard Secord, I think, made that clear. He said, well, a few millions we got on the Iran-Contra thing, that was money we deserved for all our efforts. So you see, his patriotism came at a price. And most of all, the CIA's dealing in drugs provided funds for counterinsurgency that was independent of government appropriations. So if Congress cuts those appropriations, we still have plenty of money to spend and carry out our doings. Sometimes the determination of the national security state to set itself above and outside the Constitution is not done secretly, it's done quite overtly, as when President Bush announced that he would commit troops to combat regardless of whether Congress voted up or down on the war resolutions. That was a very interesting statement. I thought it was a fascinating statement. I thought he should have been impeached for saying it. But in fact, some people call that strong leadership, determined craftsman, whatever else. He submitted it to Congress, which gave its stamp of approval, by the way, with a lot of good debate. A lot of good debate by people. I'm not being ironic. I thought there were many good arguments marshaled to show what was wrong with going to war and what was wrong with that, including statements like, the army is not George Bush's personal army, this war is unjust, immoral, the effects on our own people would be bad, and all that. There were a lot of good statements made. But the problem is, you see, the problem is that while Congress had the good arguments, Bush had control of the levers of state. The problem of the executive is that it executes. It has its hands on the levers of command and enforceable action from day to day. Fulbright discovered that during the Vietnam War. They would pass resolutions and the bombings would still go on. And he'd say, this system only works if we're going to cooperate as we're supposed to cooperate. But that's it. Congress pleading for cooperation and the executive going ahead doing what it wants. The national security state collaboration reaches deeply into other areas of life. The labor movement in this country, Social Democrats USA, Lane Kirkland, the AFL-CIA, the AFL-CIO, I always make that mistake, always do. AFL-CIO and Lane Kirkland has international institutes like AFLD, American Institute for Free Labor Development, which in Latin America, they have one in Africa and Asia, and they have one even in the U.S., working throughout the Third World, dedicated to building tame collaborationist unions that undermine the more militant and more left unions. They're anti-communist, counter-revolutionary, pro-West. The AFL-CIA and these institutions distributes funds from U.S. government agencies, and they work closely with U.S. agencies and right-wing organizations in America. The last head of the AFL-CIO was also had the faith of Jim Wright. He began to question the war in Vietnam. His name was Walter Reuther, one of the more democratic leaders of the American labor movement who had become president of the AFL-CIO. And when he began to question U.S. involvement in Vietnam, his plane blew up mysteriously in midair and he was killed. Just one of those funny coincidences that keep happening. And we got Lane Kirkland, who owes his soul to the national security state. Having said that the national security state is removed from the democratic process, is unaccountable and secretive, I don't wish to imply that it is removed from our lives. It takes enormous amounts of our money that we earn, and when they take your money, they're taking your life. Unlike a Rockefeller or a Mellon or a Morgan who may invest different parts of his holdings, what we invest for income is our life, our time, our labor, our blood, and we'll never get that time back. And a chunk of that, for many of you, the biggest yearly expense is your income tax and your Social Security tax. Social Security tax is not going into a Social Security fund, we learn. The surplus fund is being used to pay for missiles and CIA agents and White House limousines. And to pay for that $300 billion military budget and the $45 billion security intelligence budget. The national security state has a real influence over the news. The corporate class that is defended by that state is also the same class that owns the media and shares a direct interest in imperialism, which is why you can't ever hear a discussion like this in the mainstream media. As I say, you can make criticisms of some of the symptoms, but what you can't do is ask why, analyze why, what interests are involved there. Once you start doing that, once you ask for an explanation and not just make a complaint, then you move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis. And that's what becomes dangerous, you see. That was the danger, by the way. And a lot of leftists, a lot of the writings, a lot of the muckraking books, they're good books. But I was looking at Joe Gerson's book, a book on U.S. overseas bases. It's an excellent book. I recommend it to you. It's about, he wrote it with a collaborator, it's about the effects of U.S. bases in other countries, the costs of them, what they do to the ecology, how they infringe on the sovereignty of other countries, and how many there are, and this whole global network of bases. But then I remember sitting with him and a group of people, and I said, why does the U.S. have all these bases? Isn't that a good question? Why? And some people in the room said, lots of reasons. There could be a lot of reasons, you know, the inertia in the military-industrial complex, which indeed has an interest in doing that direct monetary interest. That's right. I said, but do you think that they might have an economic interest in maintaining this global military machine to keep the world under their control in the ways I've just discussed? I don't want to repeat my whole lecture here now. And one of them said, no, that's not so. Saul Lando said there's no economic interest in U.S. involvement in Central America. That it's not, I can't believe Saul said that exactly, but he might have. Because it costs more, we're spending more money intervening in Central America than the investments we have. And I said, yeah, but the investments that belong to some people up there, and the costs of the intervention are paid by us. And they will spend any amount of your money to protect their money. So, along with denouncing the militarism, you have to ask, why? Why is there so much of that militarism? That's what happened. That's when Martin Luther King ran into problems. That's when Malcolm X ran into problems. When they moved from being civil rights advocates and damned the oppression that afflicted their people and called for betterment, when they moved from that, when King began to then make analysis of the economic system and the injustices of it and the interests of it and began to make critical analysis of U.S. foreign policy, it was then that he got blown away. And when Malcolm X came back and was no longer a black separatist, was no longer a Louis Farrakhan, although Farrakhan could not shine his shoes even when Malcolm X just was in the Nation of Islam. But when he came back from that world tour and said, there's a whole world of interest, there's a thing called imperialism, it's maybe not just black against white. They'll leave you alone if you're going to divide people. There's no shortage of people get up there and divide us and say, it's us against them, it's us against them, and they got to stop doing this to us. Very justifiably, at times, the complaints that are being made. But Malcolm X started saying something else. He said, it's going to be time for us to join together and find out who are our real enemies. It's all right to preach love, but there are some people who are not very loving and not very nice and very dangerous and very violent, and they are doing things to us. And when he started saying that, why, he got shot. It's amazing how they just all just get blown away at a certain time. John F. Kennedy, when he started pulling troops out of Vietnam and began violating one of the major commitments of the national security state, got blown away too. And Robert Kennedy, when he became progressive and started to run for presidency, he got blown away too. It's interesting that there are these nuts who just kind of emerge just at a certain time and do this. James Earl Ray, let out early from Montreal jail. Here's this petty hustler. Never done anything in his life but hustle around. Had no social conscience, didn't care about A from B and all that. We were asked to believe he then devoted the next 6 months of his life, his security, his safety, whatever else, to go and kill Martin Luther King. He said he was just sitting in the car. But it is an amazing coincidence how they just kind of come along. The anti-crime bills, one passed by the Senate, supposedly to design to stop crime, and counterterrorism are measures designed to infringe upon democratic protest. By the way, it's no crime, those of us on the left, it's no crime to be against crime. In fact, it would be nice if the police in this country would begin to fight crime, you know? Frank Donner pointed out that the Chicago police had more men working on their red squads than fighting organized crime in Chicago. Washington, D.C. has a red squad that's always on us. You know, the FBI doesn't do it anymore. No, because we got the red squad, and they feed it back to the FBI. Tap our phones or whatever else. It would be nice if we get the police to really fight crime. I mean, there are about, what, 20, they estimate 20, 30 serial murderers who go around for, oh, only for 10, 15, 17 years, killing people and never getting caught. Did you see that Oliphant cartoon on that? It showed this sort of tactical SWAT team standing there with their uniforms and their guns and all that, and they're outside of this porno movie. And they had Onan police on their shirts. Those of you who never read the Bible, Onan was the guy who spilt his seed upon the ground. We're in church, we could say it. Onanism is another word for masturbation. So the Onan police, and they were standing there and saying, oh, we're going to get him, we're going to get him, yeah, and we get to see a movie too, and all that. And then over on and over on this side comes these two kind of weird, glinty-eyed guys with pushing a cart near a bloody arms and legs sticking out of it, and the two, they're labeled mass murderer, serial killer, and they're saying, excuse us, you know the way to the dump? And the cop's saying, yeah, it's about two blocks down that way, and all that. And they're here looking, three undercover agents to go catch Pee Wee Herman. Three undercover agents fighting crime. Okay, I'm not gonna slip in any Pee Wee Herman jokes. One just flashed through my head, and I'm not gonna do it. Well, there is a movement. There is a movement to have Pee Wee Herman for president. You know that. No, I don't want to do that. I can't. Well, because he's the kind of guy who's proven that he knows how to handle himself in public. The anti-terrorism features are interesting. It means anybody, if you designate these Salvadoran guerrillas as terrorists, then anybody doing solidarity work in the United States for the people of Salvador is giving aid and comfort to the terrorists and aiding and abetting the terrorists. And you can be thrown in jail and all that. Well, these kind of, you know, these kind of overtly fascist laws are coming forth all the time. So the state tries to prevent anti-imperialist work. To do so, the state must repress or constrict the democratic rights that make such work possible. The process of conservative executive usurpation of power is very much aided by a conservative judiciary. Judicial interpretation becomes a major function in that process. What the courts are now doing, what the Reagan-Bush-dominated courts are doing, and what they've done, by the way, what Reagan and Bush did is systematically appoint only right-wing Republicans to the federal judiciary, and they were almost always young, men or some few women in their 40s or early 50s. So that means they will be rendering decisions into the third decade of the next century. If Clarence Clarence Thomas gets on the court, which he very likely will, he'll be there. He could be there for another 35, 40 years. What the courts are doing now is that they're ruling that when the agency, executive agency, interprets the law that Congress has passed in a way that is in a conservative direction, the agency's interpretation shall take precedent over the law. That the agency shall be the interpreter of the law because the law has left certain things unstipulated. If the agency, by the way, if the agency brings out a liberal policy and sets up a liberal program to effectuate the law, then the court itself can overrule the agency. If Congress doesn't like it, they can always pass a new law. But when they pass a new law explicitly putting in a new interpretation, that is now subjected to veto by the president. So we always used to say the Supreme Court is really not all that powerful. That's when it was a liberal court trying to buck conservative forces. But a conservative court operating in tandem with a conservative White House can box the Congress in very well. You saw that happen on that last abortion decision, where the courts upheld the federal agency's interpretation that no monies could be allocated to any kind of medical organization or agency that counseled abortion. But left out in all the hue and cry about rights, the doctor's right to practice medicine, the patient's right to get this, left out of that was the whole question of usurpation, judicial activism, judicial usurpation, because there was nothing in that law that made that stipulation. That was something they just wrote in and invented themselves. Now Congress was indignant, and Congress is going to change that. But if Congress passes a law saying, no, there can be counseling for abortion, the president can veto it. Congress, in other words, needs two-thirds majority, which is very hard to get, this laws like this passed. The process of executive usurpation can be seen in the attack on incumbency. We don't want incumbents. Conservatives are no more against incumbency than they were against abortion until they saw the political advantage of it. Ronald Reagan left the White House bitter about the 22nd Amendment. He said, it was a terrible amendment. It denies the people the right to vote for someone they want, meaning him. He wanted to run for a third term. He was just so angry. I never loved the 22nd Amendment so much. Just watching him get all pissy and annoyed. It was really to see him seed every time that came up. You know, and he said, I'll tell you, I'm going to fight against that amendment and all that sort of thing. He went on like that. So he wants a limitless incumbency for a right-wing president. And he wants limitless incumbency for the right-wing judges he's put in. They never once have passed a law saying federal judges can serve for only 10 years and no more, or anything like that. Federal judges can serve for life. If they live to 90 or 100, they can stay on the bench if they want to. There's no mandatory retirement, I believe. But suddenly, incumbency for the legislature, for Congress. Incumbency, as you know, passed here in California. It could wipe out the Democratic liberal leadership. But an incumbency, for the first time, what you have in Congress, we political scientists for years, for decades, used to talk about how seniority advantaged the conservative elements in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party too, with the Southern conservatives. Oh, we got reelected. Now what you have for the first time is that a number of inner city progressives or other liberals have been piling up seniority, and they have been taking over some very influential positions. And there's a strong liberal element in the House of Representatives, especially the Senate Judiciary Committee is chaired by Joe Biden, who's a liberal of sorts. But whatever. Well, that's still more than they are willing to tolerate. The Government Operations Committee is headed by a left progressive, John Conyers, my buddy John Conyers from Detroit, who was raised in the city, who was elected by the neighborhood that he was born in. Now, what incumbency will do is, with one fell swoop, wipe out that Democratic leadership. What it also will do, it will amateurize the legislature. If you can serve only 6 years, you will always have nothing but freshman legislators in office passing through. Transience against a state that is quite durable. A CIA that's there all the time, a president and a federal judiciary that's there much longer. The process of executive usurpation is visible in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. This past week, the Soviet president, Gorbachev, abolished the political party. The Russian president abolished a political party, just announced that party no longer had legal status, its rights were being suspended, its membership fees and funds were being confiscated, its buildings will be taking over. All political activities in the workplace in Soviet Russia, in the Republic of Russia, have been abolished. So the workers will not be allowed to form political organizations of any sort in the workplace. Suppression of 6 newspapers. Only in that country and only in the U.S. media would that be greeted as a democratic reform. 6 newspapers were suppressed. because they were left and communist. All the other newspapers, many of them conservative, were not suppressed. Gorbachev this past week pushed edicts through the Soviet Congress. He said, abolish yourself. There are too many of you who are still resisting the reforms. What reforms? They're talking about the free market reforms. The reforms where the free market shall be supreme. And in the free market, those who have freedom are those who have the money. Abolish yourself. He cut off the microphones for debate repeatedly. He forced a vote three times until he got self-abolition. He threatened to abolish them by emergency presidential decree if they didn't abolish themselves. All of this reported rather matter-of-factly in, I guess I read it in the San Francisco Chronicle. I was in San Francisco last week. Executive emergency decree means dictatorial decree. Suspension of elected government, suspension of rights. These were hailed in the U.S. media as democratic reforms. The same process, the same week, is going on in Poland, with a little less dictatorially, where the Polish president has gone to the Polish parliament and said, I want you to suspend your powers to legislate, and I will rule by edict. And the parliament is saying, no, we're not sure we like to do that. We don't want to do that. But we have to do that. I need complete power so that I can affect the reforms. What reforms? What democratic reforms? They've got free elections. They've got all those things. The reforms which are to initiate free market capitalism in its rawest form. Rawest form. Raw. That is to abolish human services, abolish all those other cushions that are mitigating to some degree the immense suffering that the people are now experiencing in places like Poland and Hungary. The state needs the power to become a capitalist state and to push for full capitalist restoration. And capitalism needs the state power. And to get that state power, capitalism needs to curb the democratic power. You see, they were all for democracy. They could use democracy, a disillusioned people, disillusioned with the authoritarian bureaucratic rule and all that sort of thing, but a people who thought they were going to keep all the social wage and social gains they had under communism and now would get the consumerism of the West added on to it. They came in for a surprise. But to overthrow and destabilize those communist governments, all the CIA and all the other forces and all the Western forces and the Lech Walesas and all the right-wing leaders were all for democracy, representation, participation, political parties. Now that they have gotten that destabilized and they've got to change the economy, they now, having brought democracy up to abolish a particular authoritarian social order, they now must curb it to maintain the interests that they represent. It's very much like what the bourgeoisie did in the late 19th century. In a number of countries, the French Revolution was that way. You get the crowds, you get the people going against the aristocracy. The bourgeoisie used the force of the people against the aristocracy and then curbed with the Thermidorian reaction of 1792, curbed the people and made sure that their class power was maintained. And that exact same kind of process is what's going on now. And what will come at the end of this is hardship, suffering, hunger, unemployment, and a tremendous expansion for the forces of imperialism throughout Eastern Europe, what was once the Soviet Union, and throughout the globe. Democracy is not a system given to us, but it's a process of continual struggle and realization. And what we've learned is that our gains are never secured. They can be rolled back. If the contradictions of capitalism get too intense, they will come after us and make us pay the price. The myth of capitalist triumphant, that this proves that capitalism is triumphant. No, ladies and gentlemen, let me say to you that in those countries where the condition of life under capitalism is most humane are those countries where democratic forces have organized and won some things, like in the Benelux countries, West Germany, Austria, Sweden, Norway, even North America, Canada, even the U.S. to some degree. If you want to see where capitalism is really triumphant, then you should go to Guatemala, or Indonesia, or the Philippines, or Paraguay. There you will see capital investment in those countries does not suffer from labor unions, higher wages, minimum wages, environmental protections, and all those other things. Capitalism, the capital accumulation rate in the third world is 200, 300, 400% higher than it is in the first world. And that's where capitalism is most triumphant, because the essence of capitalism, the goal, its function, is not to help you, not to save the environment, not to build homes for the homeless. Its goal is to transform nature into commodities and commodities into capital. It is to accumulate, invest, to go all over the world and transform every part of the world. There's that remarkable sentence in the manifesto that Marx wrote that stuck with me. It just leaped up. It said, capitalism will search and move into every corner of the world and transform it into its own image. And that just came back to me as I was reading about the Philippines and looking at what are called the business zones. They move into these islands, these beautiful areas where people have lived for centuries, where their groves and their orchards and their fishing and their hunting and their little farmlands and quiet, and move in there and begin to just wipe out and clean out the timber and turn it into a wasteland and turn the people into paupers, having them working at subsistence wages, going into every corner of the world, destroying ancient fragile cultures, destroying decent good ways of living to be able to expropriate, to invest, to accumulate. And that process, unfortunately, has been greatly strengthened with the fall of communism. Whether or not you liked state communism, whether or not there weren't very serious and real criticisms one could have made about those existing societies, let point it out, there's no guarantee that what replaces them will bring a better life or a better world for them or for us. Well, what do you have, Parenti, a conspiracy theory? I always hear that. And I always tell the story about my son who has this poster up in his house. And it's a little illustration. It's two steer in the meadows, and one of the steer has this anguished look on its face, and it's saying, "Oh, I just discovered how they make hamburgers." And the other steer is saying, "Oh, you left paranoiacs with your conspiracy theorists. Just get hold of yourself." The mainstream apologists would give us not conspiracy. Of course a conspiracy. Of course they rationally plan and they calculate. Of course. You think George Bush really just picked Clarence Thomas like that? Or was he not, did he not have in mind a particular class interest? Oh, he's black? I didn't notice that. I didn't even realize that, you know? But he's not black. He's Oreo, we used to call it in the 60s. Black on the outside, white on the inside. Why him? What's so great about Clarence Thomas? The man's a mediocrity. There are any number of black jurists and black judges and black legal scholars and black law professors I know that could be a better candidate. But he is specially qualified because he's a right winger. Because the guy explicitly, repeatedly has come out against affirmative action, against equality, against using government for redistribution, against using government for helping and bettering the life chances of people who are suffering from class oppression and class deprivation. He's consistently done that. And that's why he's involved. Now you think George Bush didn't sit and systematically look for a candidate like that and say his being black will be good, that'll put a little spin, a little curve on it, let's see how they can handle that one. You don't think he picked David Souter? He went all over the country, and the only person he could find to ever be on the Supreme Court was David Souter from New Hampshire, a state judge from New Hampshire who'd written 3 articles in his life. No, of course they consciously plan and look, whether it's the appointment to the Supreme Court, whether it's building a national security state, whether it's taking care and destroying a people's revolution in Nicaragua, whatever they're doing, of course they consciously calculate and plan. The alternative is to have a coincidence theory or a somnambulist theory that says they just get up and do what they want and have no thought of their own interests. You can pursue your interests. Labor unions pursue their interests. Farmers, women, teachers, they all pursue their interests. But the minute you suggest that the people who own all the wealth and power of this society pursue their interests, they start calling you a conspiracy theorist. They have these vast holdings and enormous power and these overweening interests. And in the face of all those odds, we have to keep speaking truth to power. We have to keep organizing, teaching, agitating, protesting, educating ourselves and others. making a great noise, building a great pressure. Against impossible odds, the people of history have won important victories. That process of struggle against state power and for popular governance, that process of struggle is the essence of democracy. Thank you.